thank you all for coming this evening. I know you'll forgive me for having prepared my remarks a little bit more carefully than usual for the sake of the recording and to make myself more concise than I often am. The topic that I'd like to talk about is great education and the importance of fathers. I wanted to talk about this because of some reading that I've been doing over the past 6 months or a year about education in the past, and about the sorts of education that great men have received, and about the involvement that we often see their fathers having in their education. In the early chapters of Genesis, we read, "Now Adam knew Eve, his wife, and she conceived and bore Cain and said, 'I have gotten a man from the Lord.' Then she bore again, this time his brother Abel. Now Abel was a keeper of sheep, but Cain was a tiller of the ground. And in the process of time it came to pass that Cain brought an offering of the ground of the fruit of the ground to the Lord, and Abel also brought of the firstlings of his flock and of their fat. And the Lord respected Abel and his offering, but he did not respect Cain and his offering. And Cain was very angry, and his countenance fell." We read this passage, and we think of the first murder, indeed the first death of a man in history. We consider Cain's sin and the character from which such a sin could have arisen. What kind of a man was Cain to have done what he did? But what did Adam do wrong that his first son should have killed a second? Where did the father fail? We're not told of the upbringing of Cain and Abel, we're only told of the results of that upbringing. Cain disobeyed God in his sacrifice, and he refused to repent when he was given the chance. He compounded his sin instead by murder, the murder of his own brother. What did his father do wrong? Consider Adam's thoughts as he realizes in his son's rebellion the consequences of his rebellion against his own father and maker at the tree. It's not my purpose to discuss the spiritual upbringing and moral training of sons by their fathers. Rather, I intend to make some observations about the influences that fathers have on their sons' intellectual growth. But clearly, spiritual training and intellectual training are intimately connected, and we'll see the results of some of those connections as we consider some men in history. I'd like to point out also that I'm focusing on the importance of fathers, not because I believe the importance of mothers is insignificant, but because fathers, as the head of the family, are the ones to whom the injunction is given to bring up their children in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. And I've chosen to discuss the education of sons primarily, not because I think the influence of fathers on daughters is unimportant, but because historically there's more information about the educations of sons than of daughters, and also because sons will themselves become the fathers, will become heads of households, will be obligated by the same command to bring up their children in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. So the sons are the chains of fatherhood. It's unnecessary to argue the influence that fathers have on their sons. There are plenty of examples in the scriptures of the powerful influence of fathers, for good or bad, on their sons. Adam's only the first one. Consider Isaac. Why did his sons Esau and Jacob turn out the way they did? It's because of their father. What about Jacob and his sons, almost all of whom went bad? It was because of their father. What of Gideon's sons, Abimelech, who was a Cain times 70, though the 70 may not have been Abel's? And what of David and his sons, Absalom and Amnon and Adonijah and Solomon? David was a man after God's own heart, but his sons went bad to one degree or another, and the responsibility lay at David's door, and he knew it. Most of the examples in Scripture are negative ones, but they illustrate powerfully the formidable influence that fathers have, whether they like it or not, whether they use their influence well or not. But as I said, I intend to discuss the influence of fathers on their sons' education specifically, and as the scripture confines itself to principles that we can apply, we turn to other records of history for examples and for models for fathers to follow in teaching their sons to love learning. At one point in his book, The Classical Tradition, Gilbert Hyatt says that the transmission of classical learning can be traced to the relationship between fathers and sons, and he discusses some of the teachers and some of the methods of the past. He speaks there of a class of teacher in history, a group we tend to forget, he says, although we should remember them with admiration and affection. These are the fathers who introduced their sons to the great books in the beautiful languages of Greece and Rome, who awakened their interest and helped them over the dry sands and stubborn fences, and studied along with them, until often the sons became famous men whom we admire as though they had produced themselves out of nothing. It was for this, more than for their physical existence, that Pitt and Casaubon, Browning and Montaigne were grateful to their fathers. That is true fatherhood, not only to beget the body, but to help in making the mind of your son. This is an excellent way to put the matter. I like what Hyatt says. To beget the child's body and to ignore the mind is not to be a true father. When a pregnant mother rejects her child because she refuses to endure the pain of carrying the child and the pain of delivering the child, she commits abortion and is guilty of a gross sin. When a father refuses to endure the years-long pain of carrying his son's mind to maturity, when he's derelict in his duty of ensuring the education of his son, we may say that he has committed a sort of intellectual abortion and is guilty of a gross sin. Many of the fathers of whom we have a record outside the Scripture are examples of this sort of abandonment. On the other hand, many are incredible examples of devotion and sacrifice. In them we see a willingness to forego their own pleasure, and sometimes even their own welfare, for the sake of their sons, because they have a vision for generations rather than for their own lives. In Book 9 of the Iliad, which some of you will be surprised to find is one of my favorite books, one of the three ambassadors to Achilles, who pleads for him to return to battle, is the old warrior Phoenix. In his speech to Achilles, we discover the origin of his relationship to the hero. When Phoenix was a young man, we discover, his father took a mistress. His mother, in despair, asked her son Phoenix to sleep with the mistress so that the father would be shamed and return to his wife. Phoenix did so, illustrating that the sins of the fathers are passed on to the sons, and his father was so angry he tried to kill his son, and so Phoenix fled the country, repentant but unforgiven, and with his father's curse on his head that he would be barren forever. When he came to the house of Achilles' father Peleus, he was taken in and became a sort of godfather to Achilles, or a sort of uncle. He treated Achilles like the son he would never have, and like his own father should have treated him. At the end of his speech, he appeals to this relationship that the two have, and the appeal rests on the fact that though he was no blood relation, he had fulfilled the duty of a father. And Achilles, though he does not relent, and he does not submit to the appeal, is moved by the appeal and the truth of the story. Although the truth of Homer's stories has often been disputed, the story of Phoenix became for later writers a paradigm of fatherhood. Blood fathers often abandon their sons because they are often the unwanted result of another act. But Phoenix made the choice to be a father, and that, the commentator said, is a choice blood fathers can make as well, and should. But this is still not an example of a father's influence on his son's education, so let us look at a later point in history. The Greeks told a story about the 5th century BC historian Thucydides when he was yet a young boy. His father, they said, desired to expose his son to the glories of learning and of history, and took him to hear the old man Herodotus, the first Greek historian, give a public recital of some of his works. After hearing Herodotus speak, the boy broke down and wept at the beauty of the words and the storytelling, and told his father on the spot that he too wished to be a student and to become a historian, and would his father please find him a teacher? So his father accommodated the son's wishes, and Thucydides became, later in his life, the definitive chronicler of the Peloponnesian War, one of the most important wars in the history of the Western world. The Roman poets Virgil and Horace were two of the greatest authors of Augustan Rome and were approximate contemporaries. Their fathers were relatively poor men who denied themselves many luxuries and, so the accounts go, some necessities as well, in order to pay for the education of their sons. They sent them to the best schools they could afford, in their hometowns and later in Rome and in Athens. This sort of account occurs frequently in the biographies of famous men whom we admire, as Hyatt said, as though they had produced themselves out of nothing, when in fact behind them was a father who sacrificed himself for the son. The French Renaissance essayist Montaigne had one of the most thorough classical trainings ever recorded because of his father's devotion to his son's intellectual improvement. When Montaigne was still a tiny child, his father hired a German tutor to have charge over the boy's education. The tutor knew no French at all, and consequently could not speak the vernacular with the boy and his family. But he was fluent in Latin and was required by Montaigne's father to speak only Latin to the boy and in his presence. The same command was given to the rest of the family, even the servants, which tells us something about servants in that day. In this way, little Montaigne learned Latin perfectly because it became his native tongue, and his command of Latin allowed him, for the rest of his life, to read for pleasure in the ancient Latin authors with a facility unmatched by any scholar of the day. Montaigne's father also wished the boy to know Greek, but as he was already learning Latin on the direct principle, his father found another way. He invented a game in which he taught his son Greek as a private language to be used between them to carry on conversations that no one else could understand. Of course, this appealed immensely to the boy, and they spoke together and wrote to each other, until one day young Montaigne happened across some Greek text in his father's library. He came to his father in tears, distressed that someone had discovered their secret language and written a book. And his father had to confess that a great many books were written in their secret language because it was a real language. Isaac Casaubon was one of the greatest and the most erudite scholars of the Renaissance. He was born at Geneva of Huguenot parents who had fled from Gascony during one of the persecutions. At the age of 9, he could speak and write Latin. He was learning Greek from his father with Isocrates Ad Demonicum as a textbook when the news of the St. Bartholomew's Day massacre of the French Protestants by the Catholics drove them into the hills. There, the lessons in Greek were continued in a cave in Dauphin. In England, the statesman William Pitt the Younger was trained by his father. His father's method was to have William translate aloud at sight from the Greek and Latin classics. He was doing this with skill by the time he was a teenager, and it is to this education that he later attributed his immense command of the language and his fertile imagery in the famous and popular speeches that he gave in Parliament. The Victorian poet and essayist Edmund Gosse writes in his work Father and Son of the influence of his father on his love for the classics. His account illustrates the strange ways in which a young child's imagination can be kindled. Gosse's parents were what some might call typical Victorian middle-class people, very proper, rather staid, and very pious Plymouth Brethren. Little Edmund was their only child, and they loved him dearly and made him very much a part of their lives. His father was a biologist and took him with him to the shores and the tidal pools of the Cornish coast. Gosse describes with great delight the long hours they spent examining the appearance and the habits of the tiny creatures that lived there. As a consequence, Gosse was close to his father and much affected by what his father thought and loved. And one of the things that his father loved is Latin poetry. Little Gosse had been having great difficulty learning Latin at school, where it was made by his masters as repulsive for him as possible, as he says, strings of words and of grim arrangements of conjugation and declension presented in a manner appallingly unattractive. But his father heard him repeating these strings of words and took down his own old Virgil, which he says had been an inestimable solace to him during his field trips as a young naturalist when he was in the Canadian wilds and the swamps of the West Indies. There was a great scratch on the sheepskin cover that a thorn had made in the forest of Alabama. He thought of the happy months of his youth spent in the wilds and of the beloved first wife he'd lost, and he began to repeat the first of Virgil's bucolic poems by memory. The little boy could not understand a word, but was struck by the beauty of the sounds. He listened, he says, as to a nightingale, until his father reached, "Tu titere lentu in umbra, formosum reno sonare doces amarillida siluas." And he stopped his father and said he'd had enough, and then asked for a translation. But the lines meant nothing to him when they were translated. As Hyatt puts it, how could a boy of 11, brought up among Plymouth Brethren, understand the pagan shepherd singing about his sweetheart? And yet he was haunted by the music of the words. I persuaded my father, he says, who was a little astonished at my insistence, to repeat the lines over and over again. At last my brain caught them. And thenceforward he went about repeating them to himself in a kind of glory. As I hung over the tidal pools of the edge of the sea, says Gosse, all my inner being used to ring out with the sound of the lines. Gosse's writings later in his life reveal an intense love of the classics, which informs, whether in spirit or form or content, much that he wants to say. Robert Browning's poem, Development, describes his first encounter with Homer in the Greek language and the role his father played in young Browning's love of the classics. The 5-year-old boy saw his father sitting in a reading chair, absorbed in a large volume. Little Robert asked him what it was, and his father said, "It's the Siege of Troy." The little boy asked, "What's a siege, and what's Troy?" His father closed his book, stood up, put a wooden chair on the table, plopped the little boy into it, and said, "You are Priam, king of Troy," and proceeded to describe the entire Trojan War for the amusement of the youngster. The cat was Helen. The dogs became Agamemnon and Menelaus. The stable boy was Hector, and the pony was Aias, and so forth. A year or two later, seeing his son playing Siege of Troy with his friends, his father stood up, shouted out the window that he should read the whole story in a translation of Homer, which the boy immediately did, abandoning his friends. His father then suggested studying Greek. Young Robert had begun Latin not long before, at the age of 6, so that he could read the story in the words of Homer himself, and by the time he was 12, he'd learned the language and read all of Homer in the original. The poem that describes all this, Development, is regularly included in anthologies of Victorian poetry, and is an ongoing tribute to a father's willingness to include his son in his own interests and to go even further, guiding the son's interests in paths that he knows will be rewarding, devoting himself to his son's education. If we backtrack about a half century, we will find perhaps the most astonishing example of all of a father's dedication to his son's education. John Stuart Mill is one of the most famous philosophers of modern times and has recorded for us in his autobiography his memories of the training his father gave him in his youth. Mill's father had a large family and supported them all by writing for periodicals, a tenuous existence at best. He was also working on a history of England in his spare time, whatever that happened to be, and spending time associating with the other philosophers who were engaged in developing new systems of thought, including utilitarianism, that they felt were consonant with emerging Victorian optimism for the future. Mill's father began to teach him Greek when little John was about 3 years old. For the first couple of years, he learned vocabulary, and then he began to learn declensions and conjugations. Mill tells us that his father was an impatient man in the extreme with everyone, and therefore we cannot but be amazed at his commitment to his son when we read that little 5-year-old Mill worked at the same desk where his father wrote his magazine articles and worked at his History of England, and that the boy constantly interrupted his father to ask for the meaning of a word because he could not yet use a Greek dictionary, and that his father never responded with impatience to these interruptions, though he may have felt it, interruptions that coming from anyone else would have resulted in severe rebuke. When the boy began learning declensions and conjugations and attempting some translation, he got on so quickly under his father's guidance that by the time he was 8, he had read in the original first Aesop's Fables, then the Anabasis of Xenophon, all of Herodotus, Xenophon's Cyropedia, Socrates' Memorials, some of the Lives of the Philosophers by Diogenes Laertius, some of Lucian, a Socrates Ad Demonicum and Ad Nicocleum, and all of the first 6 dialogues of Plato. Remember, by the time he was 8. In Greek. His father also set young John to reading English histories. By his 8th year, besides his Greek reading, young Mill had read Robertson's Histories, Hume's English History, Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, Watson, Langhorne's translation of Plutarch, Miller's Historical View of the English Government, Mosheim's Ecclesiastical History, McCree's Life of John Knox, the Histories of the Quakers, Beaver's African Memoranda, Collins' Account of the First Settlement of New South Wales, Anson's Voyages, Hawkesworth's Voyages Around the World in 4 volumes, Robinson Crusoe, The Arabian Nights, Don Quixote, and a number of others. By the time he was 12, he had read in Greek all of Homer's Iliad and Odyssey, some plays of Sophocles, Euripides and Aristophanes, all of Thucydides, more of Xenophon, much of the orations of Demosthenes, Aeschines, and Lysias, all of Theocritus and Anacreon, and much of the Anthology, a little bit of Dionysius, some of Polybius, and all of Aristotle's rhetoric. At age 8, he had begun learning Latin also from his father, and so by the time he was 12, he had also read in Latin Virgil's Bucolics and the first 6 books of the Aeneid, all of Horace except the Epodes, part of Phaedrus, the first 5 books of Livy, all of Sallust, much of Ovid's Metamorphoses, some of Terence's plays, several books of Lucretius, some orations of Cicero, and many other works in part or whole. But Mill's father did not simply assign study and reading to his little son and then go away and leave him to it. He had some health problems and so took an hour's walk every morning for the sake of his frail constitution. From the time little John was 4 or 5, he accompanied his father on these morning walks, and he continued this habit until his early teens when he finally left home to study abroad. During these hour-long walks, Mill's father would talk with his son, asking him searching questions about the books the boy had read the previous afternoon, making sure that he could recount to him the salient points, or outline for him the pattern of the thoughts in the book, or describe to him the arguments and prove that he understood what he'd read. Besides asking questions about the boy's reading, Mill's father also elaborated on the issues raised in the books, or explained difficult points, or asked questions that provoked further thoughts in the boy beyond what the book had demanded. He would also give counsel and advice and suggested other reading for the boy to follow. And young Mill, at least according to his own account, seems to have always respected his father's counsel and followed his suggestions. As he grew, his father involved him in his own work, asking John to read a recently written chapter in his history and then asking his opinion of the style, the method, and the content. The elder Mill was well-educated himself, very intelligent, and was not interested in the slightest in pretending that he didn't know the answers to the questions that he asked, and usually corrected Mill's responses to queries about his father's work. But as Mill approached his teen years, his father took more and more seriously his son's suggestions about his work, and before long, Mill was reading philosophical and historical books and articles which his father had no time for, and he would summarize them for his father on their walks so that his father could incorporate them into his writings. Mill was so well read in history that by the time he was 12, he had written, for his own pleasure, several volumes of a history of the development of Roman law. He was a little uncertain of its value, so he didn't tell his father about it, but his father knew and subtly turned the conversation in directions which would prove useful to the writing young Mill was doing. A few years later, young Mill burned his own work, ashamed of his childish efforts. By means of the rigorous reading that he assigned and the daily conversations he engaged him in, Mill's father taught him history, philosophy, formal and informal logic, economics, science, language, and a host of other subjects. They seem not to have spent much time in casual conversation, but diligently used the time for improving his son's mind and very probably his own. By the time Mill was 13, he had gotten a far better education than most of the college graduates who occasionally clustered round his father to hear him hold forth on utilitarian philosophy. Mill himself eventually became an outstanding scholar and contributed to the intellectual life of England. The record of Mill's education suggests some interesting points about the influence of fathers on their sons and the involvement of fathers, points that are reflected in all of the accounts that we've considered. First of all, Mill's father was an exceptional man in his commitment to educating his son himself, but not all fathers chose that route. Virgil's father and Horace's, Edmund Gosse's and Browning's sent their sons to the best schools they could find and so fulfilled their duty. Montaigne's father hired a tutor because he was a wealthy nobleman and consequently was expected not to send his son to the common schools. He fulfilled his duty in a different way. Casaubon's father taught his son at home and in the hills, even in a cave, out of necessity. They were under political and religious persecution, but he fulfilled his duty. Second, all of these men knew that their duty did not end with the direct education of their sons. They were intensely involved in other ways with their son's mental growth. Gosse's father took him with him in his work as a biologist and also involved himself in his son's Latin efforts. Besides the time he gave to his son and the benefits of including him in his work, and besides the help he gave his son in Latin, he suggested to young Edmund by his own behavior that the love of knowledge continues throughout life and that there is no disunity in the universe of knowledge, that a biologist and father can be a lover of Latin poetry as well. Browning's father noticed his son's interest in his own reading and did not kill it by giving some incomprehensible scholar's answer inappropriate for a five-year-old boy. He set aside what he was doing, making sure that the boy's question was answered, and made sure the boy became interested too by making the explanation understandable and interesting and by giving himself to the boy for a time. Mill's father very properly blurred the boundary between education per se and informal knowledge gaining by taking his son with him always on his walks and conversing with him about his studies. A third point to notice is that all of these men were intensely devoted themselves to learning. They loved study, reading, conversation, and keeping company with other men who felt the same way. Browning saw his father reading Homer and asked a question that launched his own career of learning. Gosse saw the obvious love his father had for Virgil. Mill saw his father's enthusiasm for study and also sat in on the conversations that raged when his father's associates visited. J. Gresham Machen, the early 20th century defender of orthodoxy against liberalism, grew up in a household that took great delight in scholarly pursuits and equal delight in the company of others that shared their enthusiasm. A frequent visitor to the Machen household was Basil Lano Gildersleeve, one of the premier American classicists of the era between the War Between the States and the First World War. With a figure like Gildersleeve visiting the family regularly, J. Gresham was bound to be influenced by the conversations that filled his house. This sort of enthusiasm is impossible to fake, and there's no substitute for it. The sons catch the father's enthusiasms. There are plenty of fathers who send their sons off to school to get an education but show no desire for learning themselves. Some of these actually are not much surprised when their boys develop the same disregard for studies. They know the sons watch them, and they hope they pick up the attitude without the father having to come right out and say, "It's a waste of time, boy." Others are indeed surprised when their sons have no taste for their studies, and they try to beat a love of learning into the boy's head. And we can guess how quickly that develops the desire for knowledge. There's another aspect to Mill's education which is worth our attention. John Stuart Mill's father, for all his belief in truth and reason, and actually he would say because of his belief in truth and reason, was an enemy of religion. And he taught his son that religion was an enemy of knowledge and truth and dulled the mind and hampered the spirit, was illogical, irrational, and one of the greatest evils under which mankind labors. He spent many hours on their walks and elsewhere explaining to his son why religion is such an evil, and young Mill learned his lesson well. His own life was spent in largely conventional fashion, but he did flaunt conventional morality in some areas, living with a married woman with whom he later had children, and so applying the lessons of his father. The elder Mill did right in devoting himself to the education of his son, even though it was fundamentally inconsistent behavior, rejecting as he did the absolute standard of God's revelation. In fact, the dedication of this atheist to his son's intellectual well-being puts many Christians to shame and illustrates the potency of a father's influence even when he's teaching his son error. The son follows the father, whether the father neglects his duty, teaches his son badly, or teaches his son well, whether he teaches his son truth or falsehood. In the same fashion, Beethoven's father taught his son thoroughly in music, but he was also a drunk with a violent temper and beat his son when young Ludwig would attempt to take him home to sleep off his latest drunk. Beethoven gained both from his father, music and temper, whether either of them wished it or not. C.S. Lewis's father had a profound impact on his sons, though according to Lewis's remembrances in Surprised by Joy, or in other more detached biographies, his influence was not all positive. He did keep his houses chock full of books and encouraged his boys to read, and he was a lawyer and loved intellectual sharpness. And after their mother died, he tried to be the company he thought they needed. But he provoked his sons by his manner with them, and tried to be a friend instead of a father, and he failed at both. Sons will imitate their fathers. It's impossible for them not to do so, and neither of them can prevent it. The only thing fathers can do about it is to be what they want their sons to be. That is good advice, though not necessarily good news. But if we want our sons to love learning, to desire knowledge, to appreciate the intellectual traditions that belong to us, we have to model it by loving, desiring, and appreciating those things ourselves. It is not enough to devote ourselves to the schools that we're trying to build and the curricula that we believe is best. We must be earnest students of learning ourselves, on our own time. If mother believes in the value of books and shows it in her behavior, but father does not, or says he does, but does not show himself to be a lover of learning, whom will the son imitate? Of course, mothers should be devoted students of learning, but fathers must lead the way and give the mothers a path to follow. The most critical element in a son's education is not the school that he attends, or the curriculum that he studies, or the church he goes to, or the friends with which he keeps company, or the brothers and sisters that he plays and works and studies with, but his father and his father's attitude toward learning and knowledge and study. The best school is the one to which children are sent not simply to show support, but because the parents wish they were getting the education provided at that school. And they demonstrate it by their own behavior at home, by the topics of conversation at the dinner table, by the questions that they ask of their children, by the books they read to the children, by the company they invite into their homes, and by the books they read late at night when no one is watching to see if they turn on the TV. And it's fathers who bear the greatest burden. The best schools are impotent if fathers are not earnest students of learning. And the best schools pale by comparison to the fathers who are. Thank you very much. Your time is your own.